Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt, the Butt Knight.
And I am Jimmy of House Nuts.
Wow, guys, so much content to talk about, man. You know, we thought we were just going to come on here, had a great run through season one of House of the Dragon. All you guys, so much fun doing our live hangouts on YouTube, and those will continue. We will definitely be doing more of those, but just today, man, there's just so much stuff to talk about, not only in the Song of Ice and Fire, but we're going to touch a little bit about some other things happening in the fantasy realm, because I don't know, Jimmy and I want to talk about it. So we're going to dive into that first, or into that as well, I should say. So with all of that stuff, let's go ahead and start, Jimmy. There was a huge update from George Martin talking about the Winds of Winter. I don't know exactly where he was at, but I saw the clip and it's been moved around YouTube where he said that Winds of Winter is roughly about 75% done and that he thinks he could have it finished in a winter or two.
Yeah, a lot of people were shocked to hear that because me and you have been pretty optimistic, and Ez as well, back in the day, that, you know, things were getting done, that there was progress being made. I think everyone can kind of accept the fact that he probably did a large amount of rewrites at some point in the last 12 years. But this was the first time we've heard a real percentage, right, from his mouth. And even if it is more like, let's say it's 60%, not 75%, that's still way further along than a lot of the more pessimistic people would say. But I feel as if this is the home stretch. And we and you kind of said that whenever we started putting together how many POV chapters he's actually talked about finishing. Me and you both were like, this sounds like it's about 3/4 of the way. I think that's exactly what you and I had said. So this is some of the best news I've heard. I did see some people take it as a bad thing. You know, that means 4 more years, but that's not how art works. Art and the motivation to do it and all that comes in spurts. And I feel like Gurm is having a great year. Between Giants football, House of the Dragon, and, you know, Elden Ring. I mean, he's just having a bang up year. And it really does seem, even whenever he's talking, that he's a little bit more into it than he has been. There are times where it feels like he might be dead inside whenever someone asks him about the Winds of Winter. He's like, it's the same update as always. I'm writing it. You know, you can tell he just hates the questions. But this progress, man, and it's super encouraaging. And I've always said November 2024, we said it last time we were on the podcast, and I'm sticking to it. I think it might be.
I'm starting to think you might be right, man. You know, so he was on the late night. He was on the Stephen Colbert. I think, wasn't there another interview as well? It wasn't Colbert, but it was somebody else that
he's done quite a few. Yeah,
right, for the House of the Dragon. But I think it's gonna be a very big book, more than 1500 pages, and I'm about 3/4 of the way done. The characters all interweave, and I'm actually finished with a couple of characters, but not others. I have to finish all that weaving. Colbert joke that, you know, it took 10 years to finish 75%. It means, you know, at that rate, right, what's 75% of, you know, 10, whatever, it'll take you 3 years to finish, which Martin, you know, joked as depressing. So, right, you know, but it was, I did see a little bit of that interview. It was kind of funny. They did talk a little bit about Elden Ring as well. And he sort of said, man, you know, it's like they hit me up a couple years ago, actually. It's kind of crazy to think about, like, just what that is.
Yeah, man,
that progression. And man, we also just got, I mean, he's got so much stuff going on. We just got this, right, the Rise of the Dragon book. I mean, so much stuff. We'll dive into that here in a second too.
Some amazing art in that book. So the new art that was put out is really incredible. There's a new shot of the Iron Throne that I think is the best one ever.
Yeah,
really exciting stuff.
Yeah, so just, it's super, super cool. And yeah, you know, we have a video where we did a huge breakdown of like every chapter that's ever been written. You know, some of those chapters from A Feast for Crows got pushed forward into A Dance of Dragons. And then some of the stuff that was going to be in Dance of Dragons, he wanted to get in there. He couldn't. And it's going to get automatically put into Winds of Winter. So, excuse me, does feel like we are pretty, you know, close. He said he's 75%, which is still better than for years, the sort of woe is me, I'll never get it done, you can blame me, whatever you want,
Yeah. And also the fact that, like, we were not sure if he was writing at some points, right? He even mentioned in the interview that he had went back and some chapters he had finished, he went back and rewrote them because they weren't good enough, which makes me happy because if he wanted to get it out, he could get this book out, right? But he's still taking his time and working his way through it. The one thing, Matt, that I thought was really interesting is that he said it's going to be bigger than Dance with Dragons and A Storm of Swords. And then he also mentioned, what happens when I hand over a 1,700 page manuscript to the publisher, whether they're going to want to split it or do something else with it, because there are binding limitations, especially nowadays. Brandon Sanderson's been publishing some like 1,300 page chonkers. So I would hope that they, after editing, you know, maybe it would be around there so they'd be able to publish it. But I also wouldn't be surprised if we saw something that happened to actually one of George's favorite writers, Tad Williams. He was finishing up a fantasy series and he was releasing the third book of a trilogy and they had to split it. And they said, we're going to release this one now. And then in like 6 months to 12 months, we'll release the next one. So I'm very curious if Winds of Winter is going to be split. It wouldn't be a Dance of Dragons Feast for Crow situation, I don't think. I think it would probably be more likely to be, because now that the POVs are intertwining, whereas Feast and Dance, they were very far apart. I think that you could probably find like a midway point and cut the book, which is definitely not the case whenever you look at Feast and Dance and the way that they're kind of written. So very curious if something that we've speculated for a long time now, we've said that it's going to be more than seven books. We might be seeing books six and seven just out of Winds of Winter. That could happen.
Right. And it is important to remember, too. I know on the European versions,
yes,
they are split.
They're split.
Some of the books are split. And it's like, because I remember the first time we received an email and someone was like, yeah, I'm in volume two of like Storm of Swords. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? it's a thing. It's a thing over there. Yeah.
One of my good friends, AP from Ireland, he actually told me, he's like, yeah, I found Storm of Swords to be very boring. And I was like, wait, what? And then I found out that he had only read the first part. He had not actually finished the second part. So he never got to Red Wedding or any of the goodness that know. So I was like bewildered by it. I was like, wait, what do you mean it was boring? Like, it's the best fantasy book ever written, in my opinion. And it turns out that, you know, obviously they split stuff more so in Europe than they do in America. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to feel about that. I'm a pretty big, you know, I'm a supporter of letting the artist give us the story and the art in the form that they wanted to put it in. I don't like publishing restrictions, but if the book, even after editing, is 1,500 pages, I mean, there's a very large chance that they'll have to split it. So,
yeah, and I'd be fine with it. I think it could work well, and then you could actually, who knows, you could even add in an extra chapter or something, because if you're like, okay, well, now that this one's going to be done, I can go back in. And we talked about, I think you should have split it in the first place, because at least then you will have published something. And then maybe that changes your frame of mind to go back and think, okay, well, now I'm done there.
Yeah.
Because you never know. Maybe I need to go back and change something I've already written. Right. So then, but then you just keep working and working and working and working, and you'll never get anywhere. But at least once you publish and it's out there, it's hard to go back and say, well, I want to retcon that or change that.
And that is very true. One of the reasons why I think maybe this hasn't happened prior is, one, George is probably stubborn, but two, this comes actually from publishing. And I learned this from interviewing authors over on my YouTube channel, but publishers really prefer, especially in fantasy, for books to be as thick with three C's as possible, because they want to make sure that the customer is feeling that they're getting money, their money's worth out of the book. And they've done studies. People are more likely to pick up a bigger book, even if they don't have intentions of finishing it ever, than to pick up a small book, especially in the fantasy genre. So I do wonder sometimes if maybe George is like, could I split this up more? And the publisher's like, absolutely not. Like, we need it to be a doorstop, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's just wild, though. I mean, do you think a publisher would really push back? Because it'd be one thing if it was like...
if it was an up-and-comer, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's one thing. And I know you've interviewed, like, Steven Erickson, who did Malazan, and you were doing another... Who were you interviewing today?
Jenny Wertz, who did The Wars of Light and Shadow back in the 90s, and she's actually wrapping up an 11-book series this year, which is crazy. I've also interviewed Christopher Rocchio, who is writing the Sun Eater series.
Right. And no offense to any of them. I mean, they're all great authors, but, you know, they don't have a the single biggest hit on television show.
Yeah, certainly. He has a lot more pull than
There was
something in that interview that kind of shocked me, and I don't know if you picked up on this, but he actually said that he was working on The Winds of Winter, and whenever they figured out that they wanted to do House of the Dragon, which is a couple of years ago, like way before we ever knew about it, Penguin Random House pushed him to work on Fire and Blood. They said, you need to finish this book before you work on Winds of Winter. So they do have some leverage over him from contracts and such. But you're 100% correct. Like, George is probably a large percentage of Penguin Random House. It's like Patrick Rothfuss and DAW books. Like, Patrick Rothfuss, definitely, you know, upkeeps them just based on sales of Name of the Wind. So I would assume that if he wanted to split his books, he could have them split. So,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. Well, hey, speaking of books, we'll just briefly talk about this. And this is the Rise of the Dragon book. Pre-ordered this way back in the day. It's from the same people who did the World of Ice and Fire book, which I talk about a lot because it's gorgeous. Like my favorite. I absolutely love it. And it's done the same way. It's basically just another version of Fire and Blood, which contains a lot of the same text we've had from years from all sorts of different things, like the novellas, which then got into World of Ice and Fire. So a lot of the content, in all honesty, is the same. There is no difference.
Yeah, there's no new words.
There's no new words. However, I just prefer this over Fire and Blood, especially because, to me, I've said it for years, since it's come out, really. I just don't, and I'm a historian. I have a history major. I read history books, right? I went to college to read and teach history. And I think Fire and Blood is boring as all get out. It's not that the content of what is happening isn't cool or awesome, because we're seeing it in a medium where it's absolutely amazing in House of the Dragon. Mm-hmm. I just find the book to be kind of boring. And I actually can't imagine how casual fans find it entertaining. To be honest, I'm just dead serious. It's just because it's sort of this dry history where you have two competing. It's a weird book. It's just weird.
I really love it, but I understand that a lot of people bounce off of it. As a narrative, it's such a ballsy way of doing it.
Yeah.
I personally love it, but that's just me. And I'm also just like obsessed.
Right, but we're like lore heavy people. So yeah, the artwork in this thing is just, it's incredible. So absolutely fantastic. Really, my only criticism of this book, I really only have, other than that, I absolutely love it. And you had said it because you got yours earlier in the day. Again, just the artwork in this thing is just, it's so good. It is a bigger book because it's meant to be like a tabletop book.
Yep.
But you and I think are both on sort of the same page that our only criticism of it is the material that they use on the cover, which is a normal, hard material. It's fine. Like, it's a very good, it's got this sort of gloss and shine to it. However, the World of Ice and Fire, which this book is, you know, designed to be like the almost companion piece to, has this sort of like padding to it.
Yeah, it actually has a material feel.
Really loved. Yeah.
My problem is that the books cost the same amount of money. So why Rise of the Dragon should have had that. And I also thought the binding on
there's
mine was
there's inflation, loose. Man.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
This came out a long time ago. Man.
Yeah, that's true. That's
true. It's just the cover on this, it just has this sort of padding to it. It's just so cool. Honestly, I don't even know of any other book I've picked up that has this.
I'm a book collector. Like, I have some rare items.
An insane amount of books behind you.
And the World of Ice and Fire is still one of my favorite books I own. Just a tremendously put together book. The binding is strong on it. The Rise of the Dragons binding, I'm a little suspect about. I was flipping through it, and I get a feel for books. Like, I can tell when they're not gonna hold up as much. And I was a little nervous flipping through Rise of the Dragons.
It's fantastic. And we are supposed to get Fire and Blood 2 at some point, which means hopefully we get another version of this, which I think would then go up to Robert's Rebellion and perhaps Danny even, which really means it'll just be a thicker version of this, because that's what this book does. It's just like George just keeps reselling the same product over and over again, and we just keep buying it. So
just give us Winds Part 1, man. Come on.
kudos to that. I mean, they should do a big version of once he finishes, he should just do a big version of this with like illustrated for like Game of Thrones and stuff like that. Could you imagine? Yeah.
Well, also, God, you know, those Harry Potter tabletop books that they released. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine the books being released in those? I mean, that'd be really cool.
Yeah. The graphic novels, I have some of the Dunkin' Egg ones. Those are sweet. And I've looked at the Game of Thrones ones. Those are really, really nice as well. So there's a lot of different versions of these books. And even Fire and Blood. One thing I will give Fire and Blood is that the illustrations in it, the black and white illustrations are fantastic, but they do have those in some of the newer prints of Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
and the main series, I should say.
So also, we talk about Rise of the Dragons, but Folio Society, which releases collector's editions of books, they're numbered and all this other stuff, some of them are even signed. I picked up A Dance with Dragons. I have the whole collection now. It comes in two volumes and has original art done by Jonathan M. Burton, who I think is the best. Even more than Mark Simonetti, I think he might be my favorite. And you can't really see inside, but the slipcase that has, for those who are watching this, there's actually a Blood Raven illustration in here, and it's incredible. But this book, the binding is just incredible. You have a hand holding a kraken.
Oh, that's so cool. It's like a purple.
Yes, and then you have a dragon.
And that's like a gold, yeah.
Well, the dragon is spitting out the sun spear from Dorne. Isn't that incredible? And just some really amazing art in these books. So I was very excited. I got Rise of the Dragon and this on the same day, and I was just like a kid in a candy store.
Dude. And then you had to fly to Colorado for a work thing. So it's like you didn't even get to touch it. it's like, yeah, I want to I brought a carry-on. But sir, your carry-on is 200 pounds. Yeah, it's just books.
So. Yeah, it's books I've already read. I'm going to read again on this plane.
Yeah. What a new format. Ah, so awesome. Okay. So what we have today, I guess I should pull up my doc. Let me get this up here. You know, this is how it works. I always come super prepared, right? Because we have so many different topics we want to talk about. And it's like, oh yeah, let me get all these things.
It has been a good year for us, hasn't it? As a Song of Ice and Fire fans.
So much fun. Yeah. There's so much going on right now.
It really is.
Okay. So what Jimmy and I are going to dive into today is our top five favorite moments from House of the Dragon season one. I don't know what he's picked. He doesn't know what I have picked. And we each have one that is our least favorite. And so I think when we get closer to our number one, we'll do our least favorite. So we have no idea what the other person's picked. So it's possible we will have the same moments on our list. I'm assuming we probably will, right? So if one of us has it and the other person has it higher, we'll still sort of jump back and cover that again, just to be like, well, this is why I placed it higher. But I don't want to reveal where I have it placed until we get to that number. So, cool. So, okay, Jimmy, so I will let you go first at your number, and we'll obviously count down to number one.
Yes.
Or count up depending on how you look at it.
So
what is your number five?
Number five is Rhaenyra being crowned queen, which we saw in the last episode. Let me tell you what, when we started breaking this down, remember, I think we said we'll do top 10, and then we said, well, top five will make it tough. And it was tough. I had a lot of honorable mentions on here and some of them really small moments that like I feel like aren't that big and monumental. But I got to be honest, when Rhaenyra is crowned, there's like a well of emotions that opened up for me, especially, you know, knowing that Viserys is no longer around and then, you know, everyone kneeling and then Rhaenys standing in the back. I mean, it's just a really amazing moment. It was almost like a break from all the grief that we were experiencing from the fallout of Viserys' death. And I just loved it.
Yeah, that actually did not make my list, but it is an excellent moment and a very powerful scene. And I really do like how they did, now that I'm removed from it again. Mm-hmm. I really do like how the final two episodes, I mean, obviously there is some greens in the final episode, but it's really told to us through the perspective of, you know, Daemon and Rhaenyra. So I really did like how they split those up to where this is really sort of like the greens episode, and this is really sort of the blacks episode. And to get that parallel was very cool.
Yeah, I would agree. I wasn't sure how I felt about it. I mean, I liked it, but I was like, it was not the best way of going about it. But the longer I have sat on it, I also agree. Especially because it kind of like takes off a lot of the buildup from Viserys' death. Like how, like it's pretty hard to top that moment. So the pacing of the last two episodes together kind of bridge that away from Viserys' death. And I think it helps out the season in retrospect as a whole.
Okay. All right. So my number five, you probably have on your list. Ooh. And so I have it actually as Aegon's crowning. So not the full scene, just the Aegon, the ceremony of him walking up and getting his crown. And the reason I had this made my top five, and it actually pushed out a lot of things that I really thought was going to, but as a fan, you know, as I could be like, this is my least favorite scene, right? this is like, what's happening? I don't want this to happen, but it really is. It's one of those things where that's what made Game of Thrones so special, was watching the other side win. Mm-hmm. And have these huge moments just really caused you to absolutely loathe and hate the other side. Like, especially in seasons 1 through 4, anytime the Lannisters pull something off, you're just sitting there and you're just like seething in anger and hatred for them. But that's what makes the show so good. That's what really makes Game of Thrones special. And it is, and to be fair, it is an absolutely awesome scene when he's walking in and all the swords are going through, and then he's up there and he's got Blackfyre and he gets the crown. And I love the way that they did the crowning ceremony, where it was never actually focused on his face. It's showing everyone around him. Mm. And it's like zooming in on their face and he's almost out of focus. It was just a very visually awesome scene. And I just loved, you know, the way they did it, because you're just sitting there watching and you're just like, oh my, and I just hate like these guys, which is what you need.
And also, what a big moment for Aegon. We see Aegon for the first time in his life feel accepted, and we see like that power wash over him. It's a very powerful moment. And I also think it's the best coronation that we could possibly have for Song of Ice and Fire. Really felt like it came alive. I was a big fan, and it did not make my list.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right, Jimmy, what is your number four?
Number four is a scene that happens directly after the coronation, or maybe during, you could say, and that's the Beast Beneath the Board, with Rhaenys Targaryen coming up on the Red Queen. I know that this did get a little bit of flack and people were debating on the logic of it all, but I have went through tireless hours online in videos on my channel and here defending it, because I think it's a great scene and it makes my number four spot. I love Rhaenys Targaryen, one of my favorite Targaryens, maybe my favorite Targaryen. But on top of that, I just loved the fact that we had seen Rhaenys be so passive, go through so much grief and trauma at this point, to come up and then confront the Greens that way. And then also, I think this scene was improved with the follow-up episode, the finale, whenever she says it wasn't not my war to begin. And it shows that Rhaenys is still super smart. So I was a big fan of this, and it was pretty damn epic.
Yeah, I do have that on my list, but I have it higher, so I will I will hold off. But yes, I agree with you, but we will come back to it. So okay, all right. So I guess then I'll bounce, since I guess no, my number four. Okay. Mm-hmm. So my number four actually is kind of a small scene, really. It's not very long, and you could almost forget about it, but I have episode one sort of opening scene of Rhaenyra just flying and over the Red Keep and landing, and it's you know, blaring the Targaryen theme, you know, here with Daenerys and everything. And the reason I have this as making my top five, beating out so many other like epic moments, is Game of Thrones is back, man. I mean, it was like we had waited for so long for this show, and you know, we were doing it live, and everyone's there and everything, and it's just like, we are back, man. Westeros is back. And it was just so awesome to see. And I think it's also great that this is how they started the show. This is how they start the whole thing. This is House of the Dragon. These are Targaryens. And you start off with a dragon. I thought it was honestly like, it's like one of the perfect, like opening scene to this show.
Yeah, the heavy lifting that the pilot did, like that pilot was so important and had so much bias against it from season eight for it to deliver. And you're right, that opening scene is everything. What a mood setter. What? Oh, yeah. God. It is good. It is a good one. It did not make my list, but I almost feel like it should have now that, and that's why I like this. I like that we're going blind because I'm like, should I have included it?
Should I know? I know, but that's the thing is there's so many, like there's so, like this is one I was really sitting down thinking about it and I was like, man, you know, because there's all the big moments.
Yeah.
Especially, and it's more recency bias because we're doing this right after the season and it's a week to week. It's not like a binge or anything, but it was just like, man, I really want to sit and think about like which moments just gotcha. And this, that mm-hmm. was one of them.
Yeah, most certainly. And I think it might be one of the best pilots I've ever seen. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Jimmy, you're number three.
Number three is a shout out to the first episode as well, but it is when Viserys reveals the prophecy of A Song of Ice and Fire to Rhaenyra. This could have went poorly, I think, because a lot of people are fresh wounds from season eight. But I knew that when they announced the show that they were somehow going to connect it to the main show. It's the biggest money-making show of all time. Why wouldn't they? And I actually really liked it. I like that Ryan Condell ran with the whole prophecy idea from Aegon and added this into the show. It is a Ryan Condell concept. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. I think it adds a new weight to the monarchy. And also the acting in that scene was pretty amazing. And it kind of shows that Rhaenyra has to step up to the occasion. This is not just a birthright or whether or not she would be named heir, but there's a lot more behind it. And it gives a lot of complexity to Viserys and the decisions that he makes from this point forward. And we get to see that revealed to Rhaenyra, who obviously is a character that I love very much. So really, really like this scene. And I think it, the execution of it could have went poorly, but I thought it was really well done. And it was a great end to that first episode.
Yeah, this was one that actually was on my list and I pushed it off. But I 100% agree. And I think over the course of the whole season, the Song of Ice and Fire being this plot device and mover of the whole story is super awesome. And I did really love that that's how they finished episode one, because I think that was a great way to finish it, where it's like, no, this ties into Game of Thrones and everyone's watching and Twitter's, you know, going nuts and everyone's back into Game of Thrones. So to end it with this tie into the main series, I think was great.
Yeah, I would agree. I know, like I said, I know some people don't like to be reminded of season eight, but we have to be realistic in the fact that they were going to connect it to their number one grossing show of all time. So if they were going to do it, I think this was the way and I loved it.
Yeah. Okay, my number three, which you might still have on your list. We still have a few left here. I have He Can Keep His Tongue.
Oh, I did not put this on there, but it was close. It's on the honorable mentions for me.
Yeah. I think the reason I just really liked this scene was it was just so that episode in the first place, like it's the Viserys episode and you're focusing on him being old, right? And you just have the awesome scene, which I'm sure we'll both probably get to as on our list, of Viserys walking in, and it's just so cool and so epic. And then the rest of the episode is just become a little somber, as we know Viserys isn't long for this world. So it was in one way really like the big action moment of that episode. But it's also just like such Daemon's character. You know, Jimmy, every holiday season, I find myself with a dilemma. At my wife's extended family Christmas, we do a white elephant gift, and I never know what to get.
Well, Matt, spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods. The busy holiday season is here, and Uncommon Goods makes it less stressful with incredible hand-picked gifts for everyone on your list, all in one spot. Gifts that spark joy, wonder, delight, and that it's exactly what I wanted feeling.
Yeah, they scour the globe for original, handmade, absolutely remarkable things. Somehow they know exactly the perfect gift for every single person you know. Here's a few of my favorite gifts that I found on their website. Things like chocolate from around the world, handcrafted cribbage boards, wine glasses, bourbon sets, just about anything you want to find that would be a unique or uncommon gift, they have in their selection.
And when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches, so shop now before they sell out this holiday season.
Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade in the U.S. They have the most meaningful, out-of-the-ordinary gifts anywhere. They even have gifts that you can personalize.
And from holiday hosts to hostess gifts to the coolest finds for kids, to hits for everyone from book lovers to diehard sports fans, Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, not the same old selections you can find just anywhere.
And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/bendtheknee. That's uncommongoods.com/bendtheknee for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF, Donnelly Stewart Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
To have this, and it just sort of catches you off guard. It was, you know, some people argue, well, shock value or whatever, but it was like, that's the kind, that is like Game of Thrones. That's Game of Thrones, man. That's how it happens. 1 minute you're there and the next you're dead. So yeah, I thought it was awesome. And I think it was a really good mood setter to get everyone even more so on Damon's side.
Yeah. And also, it's just the spectacle of it. You know, I know some people push back on that, but at the end of the day, like the show has to be entertaining. And if that wasn't a jaw dropping moment for me and also for Veyman, it delivered for me, and it was one of the big oh snap moments in the season.
Yeah. Okay. So you're number two, Jimmy, right?
Number two. And I really sat down, folks, and I really tried to not have recency bias. But when I thought about the, not just the story beats, but the execution of the scene and the cinematography, the acting and the music and everything, Luke's death in the finale with Aemon and Vhagar and Arrax going to war and them not listening. And then the biggest moment of all for this, not just kicking off the war, but the fact that the dragons do have some agency. I loved everything about this. And the scene itself is just incredible. The silhouette of Vhagar over top truly felt like a Godzilla movie. Even whenever Luke lands and we just see Vhagar just looking like a mountain. I mean, I don't know. Everything about Luke's death scene, the last 15 minutes of the finale were chilling, and I have not stopped thinking about it since it happened. So I had to give it my number two spot.
Okay. I am almost 100% certain that my number two spot is your number one spot. So I think we can wait to talk about that as well as my number one. So let's dive into our least favorite moments. And I guess I'll go since I didn't do my number two, because I'm 100% certain it's your number one. And if it's not, I guess we'll go back. So we just play it by ear here. So my least favorite moment in the season, I have as Masaria talking to
anyone.
Well, you know, Masaria in episode 9 talking to Otto Hightower. And I know a lot of people are criticizing her accent and stuff like that. I guess I didn't really have a lot of issue with that. I guess for me, my problem with that scene is, one, it just doesn't, she's saying, you know, the people give you the power, is what she's trying to say. So in some sense, you could make an argument. It's sort of a throwback to a few moments in Game of Thrones, right? Like in season one, you have Robert talking about how we need to worry about the Dothraki army. It's one army. And I thought that's just such a great scene in Game of Thrones. And then also you have Cersei and Peter Baelish talking about power. You know, power is power, which is another great scene. Doesn't happen in the books. But at that point, we had already seen Baelish climbing the ladder. Mm-hmm. So it felt like, ooh, he's now overstepping, as opposed to this character who we've seen with Missaria in three episodes. And there's also the time jump. And we also, at that point, hadn't seen her. The book readers, we know she's important. But casual viewers are like, who is this again? Right? Oh, wait, yeah. She's just the girl that was with Damon in those first two episodes. Like, they don't know, oh, that she actually runs this brothel. She's a whisper. You know, like, it just wasn't the same. It just didn't have the same. I mean, you do see her. You see the woman go to tell her that King Viserys is dead. But, okay, we still don't know why she's important or why she's powerful. To the casual viewer, you just, oh, okay, they just went and told that lady again. So I just felt like the scene with the time jump and you only saw her the first few times, it just didn't hit, I think, as hard as they wanted it to. And then, of course, also then it's, you're trying to make this play that the people are the ones who give you the power, and then later in that episode all the people die because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I just really, you know, didn't feel like the scene, if I have to criticize one scene, that to me is the one I don't think hit as well as they wanted it, or it just didn't to the audience. It was just, yeah, didn't hit as well as they wanted it to.
Yeah, I've kind of liked a little bit of the subtlety with Missaria. It definitely isn't super on the nose. Like whenever someone runs to her, which is obviously we find out, I think it's Talia or Tanya. I can't remember, the queen's handmaid runs and tells about the dinner, right? The big, hey, my cousins are very strong gimmick, right? So it wasn't really on the nose with that. And I do think they have a lot of work to do to put her over as a character in the future seasons. I figured that this would probably be one of the bigger changes from what we get in Fire and Blood, which is, you know, very few and sparing with most details when it comes to her. It was a little jarring, I think, to see her battling with Otto without the proper kind of backing to this.
Right.
I do think, and I think we both can agree, that this could be building up to something that comes out in the future. But I would agree. My least favorite thing, the number one thing I technically have two, because the one isn't a scene, and mine is Masaria's accent. I think it's horrendous. I cringe when she's on. I like the character. I just hate the accent. And I don't care if it doesn't make sense. I would be fine if she just changed the accent in season two. Like, I hope someone pulls aside the showrunners and go, hey, have her stop that, because it's not good.
Because it is a choice, too.
Yeah, because she's a great actress, by the way. I've seen her in other things, and people were showing me clips. She's a fantastic actress. She does not need this ridiculous accent that is, I mean, pretty bad, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the goal was to try and make it exotic. It also didn't seem as awkward in the first two episodes as it did.
When she talks more and more, it gets worse. It's just not. I don't like it. But if I had to pick a moment in the show that I did not care for, it's not the fact that I didn't like the plot beats. I actually really like the ending plot beats of these things, but I think that they needed more time. And that is the end of episode six, where we see Laena burned by Vhagar and where we see Laerys kill his family in Harrenhal. Mm-hmm. I wish that would have been two episodes. I was reserving judgment on that. I said when we did our live reaction, I said, yeah, this feels a little rushed, but like, we'll see what the season entails. But I think about this, like what you just said, the conversation with Masari and Otto, you know, that's some time that could have been maybe given to Harwin Strong or Laena.
Yeah,
it
didn't have enough context to really.
And it's a huge moment. I mean, it's a really big and impactful moment. I think Laena getting agency to decide the way her life ends is really important to the story. And also, I hate the fact that she mysteriously just escapes the birthing bed and gets to Vhagar when everyone's like, where'd she go? And it's like,
right.
It's a bit Hollywood, and there are going to be liberties like that taken with any TV show almost. But I would say that was probably my least favorite part of the show, not the actual plot beats, but the fact that it was a little bit rushed. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get to our number ones. I'm pretty sure my number two is your number one. So yes. I'll let you go here.
King Viserys. walk to the throne. The whole thing, the crown falling, Daemon putting on his head, the announcement, King of the Andals, all of the seven kings. I mean, might be my favorite Westerosi TV moment of all time. It's perfect. The music, it's perfect. It's the best part.
And it totally changes the way we view him as a character. And the best part about it is that George Martin says it's better than his character in the books. So George is giving it his blessing, because in the books, Viserys comes across as like just sort of an average king who lets the
realm
fall into civil war.
Yeah. And he's so much more of a complex character. And for this to be his final stand, and it's not some grandioso battle or any of that. It's simply a man protecting his daughter and doing his duty as king. And there's something about the thematic value of someone doing the best for where they are at. And Viserys is at the end of his life and makes a massive impact on those that will remain living. I think it's just like one of the most gorgeously executed. I'm getting chills just talking about it. I love it so much.
Yeah. And I had it as my number two, and it's an absolutely fantastic, just amazing scene, because the Viserys's whole character, there was stuff, the buildup to it as well was also really cool, because Viserys choosing, I want to dine with my family tonight. Mm. And he throws away the milk of the poppy. So then he walks in right as Rhaenyra is getting ready to defend herself in this claim, and he comes in and lays down the law. It is an absolutely amazing scene.
And give an Emmy to the Kingsguard who announces him into the room, because the bass in his voice, I was screaming at my television. Epic.
Yeah. It is an absolutely amazing scene, and one of the best in all of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Okay. So for mine, for anybody who's been paying attention, I said earlier there was one I hadn't touched on yet, and I will wait because I have it much higher. And my number one is The Beast Beneath the Boards.
Yeah, it has.
So, I mean, you can, for the people who don't like it, you know, you can say you're just picking the shock value that doesn't happen in the books, all that stuff. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, because it was hinted at multiple times in the prophecies of Helena Targaryen. So I think that it will actually help her character going forward, because now you're going to pay a lot more attention to her. And there's a lot that happens with her character that I'm curious to see how it goes with a lot more of her prophecies that she will have. Mm-hmm. And I think this being one of them is like, you really should pay attention to her. So in one way, it sort of helps Helena Targaryen and helps establish her character. It also is like, it's shock value, but it's shock value done in the right way. It's an awesome scene, and it has all of the casual fans talking about it. Like the casual fans that I know that don't even know I run a Game of Thrones podcast or anything. And you're just talking about, oh, you know, like, what are you watching? And there's stuff like that. You know, like, wow, when that lady came out on the dragon, like, that was awesome. And that's what you need. That's like what you, this, remember, there's so much that went into, is this show even going to succeed? Right.
Yeah.
Is House of the Dragon even going to succeed with the stigma of the final season of Game of Thrones? Also, successor sequel shows, we talk about it more often than not, fail. Hard, very, yes. Very, very hard. I mean, so many of some of the biggest shows in the history of television that have tried to have a successor show falls so fast on its face. So this show is not only just, oh, hey, a sequel to Game of Thrones. It's like potentially the rest of Westeros on television, right? Mm-hmm. You have like a merger happening. So there's like a lot of money and a lot of things and a lot of big moving parts in the Hollywood industry and all this stuff hinging on this show. And to have a moment like that where Twitter's talking about it and everybody's like, oh my God, this is so awesome. And to showcase like a dragon being super epic in that moment.
Yeah.
It was so awesome.
Yeah. And I actually love the fact that Rhaenys does this decision and it ends up, it makes us raise the question of, well, what about all these small folk that were killed? And some people are saying, traitors. Look, they didn't even think about it. Yeah, traitors. They were there. But a lot of people are saying they didn't even think about it. It's like, no, I think they did think about it. And I think that it is a part of the critique on monarchy. It's also the supremacy of my bloodline being worth more than these peasants. I think that plays into it. And we like to take sides. It's fun to be tribal. But at the end of the day, I mean, most of these people in this ruling class are terrible human beings.
And that's
just something we kind of accept in Westeros. And people, you know, I can't believe they didn't think about the small people. Well, let's just wait and see what happens. Let's see what happens later in the story. Maybe the peasantry or the peasants of King's Landing are a character in this story too. As a whole, they are a character. And we should definitely take note of that and put it in the back of our minds. But a lot of people are pointing at that as being a critique of the scene, but I actually disagree completely. I think that it is an intentional part of the scene, and it is something that we should judge against Rhaenys for sure.
Yeah.
But we can still be fired up about it because, you know, Team Black, let's go.
Right. Exactly. Well, at the same time, though, she is still, you can see she is still sort of acting for herself a little bit, because, which is great because you need that, because, you know, it's what I've said it before. What made Game of Thrones so special was we didn't know the ending. And everyone was picking sides because in theory your team could win, right? It's like we saw the show where you're killing all your favorite characters. It's like the Lannisters could win the whole deal, right? It could just be some story about this is, you know, how life works and all this stuff. We didn't know, so people were like Team Lannister all the way, right? So here I think it's good to have some of these third parties,
wild cards,
that exist to sort, because you need that. You need that. Otherwise, it's just really like Team Black, right, versus the terrible Hightowers and everything.
Not to mention that the chess piece of the Valyrians are very important, especially huge with the Lannister fleet. I thought that the finale of the season really put Corlys over, and Rhaenys' scene following up her episode 9 moment was excellent. And, you know, watching her not kneel to Rhaenyra until she could see that she was actually ready to be queen and that she was going to be the one that she wanted to back, really powerful. And Corlys walking into the room and saying, what's the lay of the land? Let's go. Let's figure this out. This is what I can provide. I mean, I think all the pieces were put in place very, very well. And you can't do that and have that feeling of importance without Rhaenys having her moment of finally having agency in the show and not having just terrible things done to her. And, you know, some peasants lost their lives that day, but unfortunately that is how
they were traitors. All right. They were there. They know that everyone swore fealty to Rhaenyra. Okay. And then everyone's back in the wrong side. So,
I mean, it was kind of funny how they got ushered in there, and like, even during the coronation, you could feel like this awkwardness where like,
what are we doing here?
Are we supposed to clap now? And they're like, hell yeah, he's got the crown on, whatever. Like, we're here. At least it's something else other than getting fleas. Right. You know? Right?
And how dumb. Like when Otto's standing up there, he's like, open the doors.
OSHA is going to have a field day with us.
Seriously. Okay. All right. Well, let's do we have a few quick honorable mentions here that we can just sort of fire off? Do you have any that you wanted to put on your list that didn't make it?
Yeah. The Brackens and the Blackwoods moment. I mean, if you were talking about petty stuff, I thought that was just excellent. I love the pink dread, like the dragon tamers, like the boys in the pit. I love that. I had the
crab feeder. There's a lot of stuff from that episode that almost made my list.
I mean, honestly, dude, when Alicent walks into Rhaenyra's dinner for her wedding announcement with Laenor, when she walks in the green dress, or what about even the Valyrians showing up to that dinner? I mean, that dinner scene was fantastic.
And I know it's kind of an awkward scene, but given the importance of telling her father off, and then immediately going to talk to Laris and having to still play the Game of Thrones with, you know, his feet fetish.
Listen, we're dominating the feet fetish.
We are dominating. I posted a picture in our Facebook group and on Twitter. Once we posted that video, now the top trending search item for our podcast is now Sir Laris and feet. So, well, I guess that's where
we got to play to our strengths.
But still, I mean, it was just kind of like it's a powerful scene because of what the scene that the whole thing together. And another scene, I mean, God, so many scenes of Viserys, right? But one that really stuck out to me is when Daemon comes back and after he brings him the crown, and Daemon and Viserys are on good terms and they're hanging out, and Allison's like, oh, you know, there's like an art gallery in town we can go see. And Viserys is like, oh yeah, like we really want to go do that. Like, it just blows her up, because that's like his character. That's what, you know, he doesn't really care about Allison like at all, right? He calls her Emma at one point. I mean, and she has to like live through that. So you get her side of it too. But I don't know why that scene too, that's like just so much of like the good political drama richness of Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Very subtle and like a small moment that is easily forgettable. And there's also some foreshadowing for stuff that's going to happen in the final season. And that was in episode 4, and we won't talk about it anymore because we're going to keep it spoiler free here on the podcast, but we're going to come back to season 1 a bunch. And as we keep going through this show, and I think as a whole, this has an opportunity to be a masterpiece of a television show. So I'm really, really excited.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's going to be absolutely amazing. So, okay, with that, let's move on to another just quick topic. This is not a Game of Thrones topic, although it could be, because there are rumors about this actor's potential may have a potential role.
Yeah,
in A Song of Ice and Fire. And now it seems he's got a big contract, I'm guessing, with Warner Brothers again, because he's had a rocky relationship with them in the past 10 years, which is crazy, considering the general lack of content produced that you'd think would be the case. But Henry Cavill stepping down as The Witcher after this season.
Yeah.
And again, this isn't Game of Thrones related, but I still just wanted to talk about it a little bit, because Jimmy and I cover fantasy, and right, I cover video games, he covers fantasy books. So hey, it works out perfect because we talked about The Witcher. Man, is that show dead?
Yeah, so for me, the show is, Liam Hemsworth, it's not his fault, and I don't envy him. I mean, I'm sure he's getting paid to bag, but like, I you know, good for him on that regard. But no one stepping into this role could really fill the shoes of Geralt of Rivia quite the way that we had with Henry Cavill. And I think that he was the glue to the show. Like, even when the show, because I like the show, I think it's good. I don't necessarily think it's phenomenal. And right now with these bigger shows coming out, you know, and, you know, we cover House of the Dragon, but a lot of people do like Rings of Power as well, right? So these are bigger shows. Wheel of Time season 2, hopefully it's going to have some big improvements. So Witcher is like in this really weird spot where it's like the fun fantasy show to watch. Like, you have the Monster of the Week sometimes. It's a good time, but Henry was holding the show together. And without him, I can tell you even now, I'm not as interested in watching season 3.
Oh, I'll still watch. I'll definitely
I'm going to watch it, but I'm not as hyped.
Right. Like, season 2 was much better than season 1, even though season 2 gets a little further away from the books, which I'm fine with, because the games are their own thing. And Witcher 3 is like one of the greatest games ever made. Right. They're remaking Witcher 1. They just announced it. So it was like, man, this week we thought we were getting, it's like, oh, hey, they're remaking Witcher 1 season 1. This is going to be awesome. And it's like great Witcher news this week, and then terrible Witcher news this week. So
yeah,
totally sucks. But I almost wonder if he's actually, man, you know, if this is just a missed opportunity, because Netflix has 1 season left of Stranger Things. And once that's over, they don't really have their like big mega number one. I mean, Stranger Things is like Game of Thrones, Mandalorian. I guess, you know, you can argue Rings of Power. It is that level of show for them.
Yeah.
The Boys, right? I guess that's another huge show for Amazon. I guess, you know, it's on that level of like the best shows of the year. So it's kind of felt like maybe The Witcher is going to be that next thing. But yeah, Henry Cavill stepping down after this final year. And then, like, if you told me it was Chris Hemsworth, right? You know,
even
it's
then.
Like, oh, it's like, okay, I guess I could see it because he's Thor and now he's going to play that. No, it's his brother.
And Cavill, he's a big fan of the Witcher books, and apparently he had a lot of falling out with the producers of the show whenever they started to kind of like veer away and dumb down Geralt a bit. Like, he fought for more dialogue in season 1, supposedly. So this is a guy who like cared about the lore and cared about the show and cares about the fandom, And no matter who steps into that role, it's hard to imagine, you know, a Hollywood actor being that nerdy in a way, right? So it hurts it. But my invitation, and Henry, if you're listening, I know you're a big fan of the show. We need an Aegon the Conqueror.
Yes.
We need an Aegon the Conqueror, whether it's for a flashback in House of the Dragon. Maybe they do a movie of Aegon the Conqueror. I don't know. Right. But tell me that Henry wouldn't make a perfect Targaryen.
Oh, my God. Or a perfect Kraegan Stark, if he wants to be in House of the Dragon, or if he wants to be in a Robert Baratheon, a young Robert Baratheon. He can do whatever he wants. My guess, though, the rumors are speculating that now his agent, who, by the way, has to be the single worst agent in the history of Hollywood. Okay. Because this agent is the one who made him in the first Justice League movie, right? Because they did all the shooting and everything. I guess technically, hey, that movie was like done. And then they had to go do some reshoots. That was like old Warner Brothers, AT&T Warner Brothers. And then remember the first Justice League came out and he had the weird CGI, like no mustache or whatever. So that was actually like the last movie he acted in. It was like 2017 or whatever when that movie came out, because it was for Mission Impossible was the deal. He had to keep this mustache for Mission Impossible. And that could just be Tom Cruise being like, I know how to move stuff in Hollywood. And after seeing Top Gun Maverick and everything, Tom Cruise can do whatever he wants. So he's, you know. But then he signs his contract with Netflix where it's like, you're not allowed to act in literally anything but The Witcher.
Yeah, very bizarre.
It's the dump, like what? For like 2 years or whatever. So I don't know really what happened there, but that's totally dumb. Because the only other thing he was in was Zack Snyder's Justice League, which is just using all already shot footage. But seems like, hey, The Rock was the one who said he'd been fighting for 6 years to get him, because Superman, right, has appeared in a couple DC projects, but he's been silhouetted out or like they don't show his face. It's like technically Superman was in Shazam and in Peacemaker, but you don't see Henry Cavill. You just see this like silhouette or somebody playing Superman. But he, I guess spoiler, it's kind of all over the internet. And to be fair, The Rock has been talking about it for like the past like 3 weeks before the movie came out, is that he actually shows up as like the end credit scene in this. So it seems like we're trading Geralt of Rivia for Superman. But at the same time, that now means that he's going to be locked in here to Warner Brothers, which means it's easy to do that crossover. Right.
And from what I understand, he's a fan of A Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh, he would have to be.
So, who knows? I would welcome him with open arms.
You and I have talked about the possibility of really you could do an Aegon's Conquest as a movie.
I think it'd be better as a movie. When you really look at it and you look at the events, I think it'd be better as a big budget. It could be 2.5, 3.5 hour movie. Some people will say, what is it, Reign of Fire? Is that the movie from back in the day? Some people say that is Aegon's Conquest, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
From like 2008 or something.
I know. I don't know what movie you're talking about. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe. I mean, hey, if The Sopranos can get a movie that was kind of mediocre.
Yeah.
Then, right. I mean, then Game of Thrones, definitely. HBO is willing to say, hey, we can have our stuff go be in a movie.
Yeah. And hopefully better than that. Hopefully.
Yeah, the Sopranos movie was kind of, I just watched it after plowing through the whole thing. It was kind of okay. It wasn't, I mean, the movie itself was just like, and then they had some weird casting choices. It was just weird.
Yeah, I would hope that they would be able to execute an Aegon movie a little bit better. It would definitely be a spectacle, though, going to see that in IMAX. Are you kidding me?
Oh, that could be so, so sick. That movie would make, that'd be a $1 billion movie.
The Black Dread ridden Henry on his back. I mean, come on.
So sweet.
Give it to me. Give it to me.
And the idea of Henry Cavill having two wives makes perfect sense. You know, like that's gonna be like the first time that like the inset and like multiple wives, like nobody questions it. They're just like, oh yeah.
He's just being a Chad. Just being a giga Chad.
Awesome. All right, guys. Well, hey, thank you guys so much as always for watching, for listening, for supporting us. everything you guys do. We very much appreciate all of it. It's been so much fun covering House of the Dragon this season, as well as all the stuff we will have coming in the future. I do also want to get, and I might just put it on Patreon. Haven't looked at the schedule just yet, but I want to do like a Zoom hangout for like those top tier bannermen. Yeah. I'm tentatively actually even thinking of maybe perhaps like this Saturday, just because I know I have it open, or even like next Sunday, the 6th, November the 6th or something, and doing that and getting some of your guys' thoughts and what you guys thought about that. So for those of you guys who are patrons and stuff like that, just stay tuned to keep a lookout on the Patreon page. I'll post something about that. Or if you're looking to become one, obviously you can hit that up as well. So awesome. All right, guys. Well, hey, with that, as always, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And remember that winter is coming.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.